It's member-supported Hawaii Public Radio and Helping Hand. I'm Dave Lawrence. Fridays, we put the spotlight on an organization, topic, or event that helps the disabled or the most vulnerable. And today, the latter is our focus. And it's an animal, one that's been called the most vulnerable creature on the planet due to a threat with roots in Asia. It's the rhinoceros, now facing a rapidly growing extinction crisis of poaching. It's largely based on demand for its horn in Vietnam and China, despite scientists and doctors around the world who have said that rhino horn has no medicinal or other value, except to the animals it's violently stolen from. It began 8 years ago, fueled by an internet and word-of-mouth rumor that rhino horn cured a Vietnamese government minister of cancer. That unfounded rumor created massive demand and raised the price of the horn to levels exceeding even gold. To put it in perspective, there's been a 6,000% increase in rhino poaching since 2007. Our guest today is a nonprofit with a unique plan: translocate rhinos from South Africa to Australia. Ray Dearlove is the founder of the Australian Rhino Project. Born and raised in South Africa, in the late 1980s, he emigrated to Australia. After a successful career working in IT, in 2013, he founded the Australian Rhino Project, which now has backing from both the Australian and South African governments, as well as significant conservation figures like Jane Goodall. We'll learn more as we welcome the Australian Rhino Project and Ray Dearlove to HPR and Helping Hand. Thank you very much, Ray.
My pleasure, Dave, and thank you so much for the opportunity.
You're quite welcome. Explain, if you can, before we get into the program, your personal background as to where you grew up and what you did before you moved to Australia.
Sure, Dave. I was born in South Africa, as you said in the introduction. I was born in the northeastern part of the country, which is very close to Kruger National Park, one of the most famous parks in the world, which is home to the Big Five and many, many, many other species of birds and reptiles and so on. When I was very small, actually very young, because we lived so far away from the sea, everybody would go to the sea for their holidays, and we didn't. We went to the Kruger National Park. So I can remember as a little tacker going in and sitting in the back of this car with my mother and seeing these enormous animals, or not so enormous animals, and being captivated by them. And ever since that time, I think not a year has gone by that we haven't, and it's now we, my wife and I, and our family, have not been to the Kruger National Park or other parks where one can see these animals in their natural state. So that's how I grew up, and as I say, that continued for many years. I spent most of my life in IT, working for American companies such as IBM, EMC, and NetApp. And we emigrated here to Australia in Sydney in 1987, so that explains my confused accent, I think, Dave.
Compared to visiting Kruger or other wildlife parks today in Africa, did you encounter many more rhinos then when you were a child, Ray?
Oh, look, up until, as you said, 2007, I mean, it wasn't something that we even considered, that, you know, that there was an issue with rhinos or any other animals. But now, I was back there last year, and I didn't see one, not one rhino, and we were in the Kruger National Park for 3 days. And so that, I mean, things definitely have changed. As you said, it's since 2007. In 2007, I think the numbers 13 or 17 were poached. Last year, it was 1,336. And the previous year, 1,215, and the previous year, 1,006. And we really believe that those numbers are understated, Dave, because the Kruger National Park is such a huge area, which is where most of focused poaching takes place, by the way, is that I don't believe that, well, they can't. They don't find all the carcasses. Do they count the calves and so on? So those numbers are almost certainly understated. And that brings one to what they call a tipping point. So when the kill rate of the rhinos exceeds the birth rate, then you've got a problem. And particularly since the rhino has a gestation period of about 16 months, they only drop one calf at a time. The incidence of twins is not known at all. And then the female or the cow is ready again in between 3 and 4 years. So you can imagine that when you get behind on the birth rate versus the killing rate, it is a major issue. And there are a lot of people, and I'm one of them, who believe that that tipping point has been reached.
If folks Google Ray Dearlove, Australian Rhino Project, and Washington Post, there is an article that features an interview with you and a graph which illustrates the point which you just made, which is the dire nature of the drama that has occurred only in the last 7 or 8 years. When the issue of the rhino extinction crisis began to touch you so deeply, if you can point to when and how that happened.
Yes, I was certainly aware of it, but I must admit that not to the extent that it was happening. So 3 years ago, almost to the day, I had a call from a chap with whom I had worked at IBM in South Africa, and he suggested that, you know, starting up a breeding herd of rhinos in Australia, because climatically and from a vegetation point of view, it would seem to be a good fit. And when something like that gets thrown on you, Dave, you really did set you back in your heels. And I thought, gosh, well, that's quite something. And then spoke to the family, and you know, we all love the bush and love the animals, and we decided, let's give it a go. So that was, I suppose, a little bit like an epiphany, but today I'm grateful that he did think of us, and we've come a long way just since then. And he was thinking outside the box, and I'll tell you, when you've got situations like this where all the traditional methods look to be failing, I think you need to look outside that box. And I'll just give you a specific example, if I may. Everybody knows Warren Buffett, the Buffett family. Well, the Buffett family apparently have owned some land in South Africa in a game park for many, many years. To make a long story short, Howard Buffett, Warren's son, offered to donate some money to the National Parks anti-poaching effort. And I've heard the story direct from the chap who was the recipient of this. And anyway, he donated $25 million to this anti-poaching thing, which is admirable and fantastic. But here's the thing, Dave. The numbers have gone up. So if one looks at traditional methods of trying to manage this thing, you've got to look and see if there are any alternatives. And that's what we've tried to do. And not for 1 minute, Dave, do I believe that, you know, that what we're doing here will save the rhino. It won't be of sufficient scale. But there can be, in my humble opinion, that in 5-10 years' time, there's a strong breeding herd with genetic diversity here in Australia, so that if the wheels fall off completely in Africa, when they come back on, we can actually help repatriate or reseed any populations that might be there. That's the grand plan. Dave, let me be honest with you. I would rather not be doing this if it was not necessary. I mean, it's a critical situation, and if they had resolved the poaching thing tomorrow, I mean, I would be the first person to put up my hands and say hurrah, hurrah for that. There was a development. The CITES organization was having their annual, or every 3-year conference in Johannesburg come September. And one of the burning issues in this whole rhino thing is whether or not to legalize the trade in rhino horn. And their expectation was that South Africa, who's keeper of probably 95-98% of the rhinos in the world, would put forward a proposal to legalize the trade in rhino horn in belief that it would bring the prices down and stop the poaching. Well, the South African government said they would not be putting a proposal forward to CITES. So that'll come as a relief to many people, come as a disappointment to others. But it's a really, really key development in this whole thing.
Yes, I'm aware of it. And I don't think your idea is far-fetched at all. I think the reality that this is not some ferocious animal. This is much more like a cow with a very expensive fingernail growing out of its head. And when I think of your plan and what you're doing and dialing back in on it, because I'm looking at it, I see every day, and the poaching is an ongoing thing. And when you talk about Mr. Buffett's generosity, which is outstanding, there are 2 to 3 rhinos being killed every single day. And when we talk about killed, it's like people shoot an animal several times that is not dead, then they hack off half of its head. The animal is left alive. It is then still alive for days. Someone finds the animal, it's quivering, laying on the ground in a state of agony I can't even begin to imagine, and there is no putting it right. To me, there is no question that this thing has to come to an end. So I guess the question would be for you, why just 80? What if you could harness this concept and literally just start hauling them out of there 20 a week?
Dave, firstly, thank you for sharing that with me. And look, I appreciate it. And in terms of getting emotional, because I can hear that in your voice, that's how I get myself. When I get these images sent to me, and because I'm a kind of a go-to man in some ways in this thing, I get a lot. And it really, I mean, I moved to tears. There was a recent one, exactly the one that you might have seen down at Sibuya, down in the Eastern Cape, where these so-and-sos shot 2 cows dead. There were 2 orphans just lying next to them or standing next to them because they don't know what's going on. And they also shot the bull. And they took the bull's face off, but its horn off, but he survived, just like you said. And because they've got a drink every day, he made his way to a waterhole and didn't make it. And they found him literally submerged in the waterhole dead. I mean, it's just a bloody awful thing. So why not more? Dave, it's just, I hate to say this, but it's a fact of life. Everything comes back to money, doesn't it? It's a very expensive exercise, Dave. The animals, and you know this, your listeners may not, is that, you know, a large size rhino will weigh 2,500 kilos. And I mean, that's a damn big animal. And so that's one aspect, is just the cost of getting them here. The other thing is that there is a sensitivity in South Africa about the fact that the world seems to think that they can't manage the issue. And they're doing a lot to try and manage the issue. So if there is a plan, by the way, which is not being executed, to bring a whole lot of rhinos to Texas. I guess from our point of view, it's an economical thing more than anything else. And I'm hoping to overcome that with the support of people like yourself and your listeners. So I would love to do that. But practically, the other thing, that which is a really important point here in Australia, is Australia is absolutely neurotic about biosecurity. You know, it's an island, so they protect what comes in that won't contaminate the fauna and flora in any way, and that is paramount, because otherwise they don't get free trade agreements signed with India and China, as they have done. So we are put really through the ringer in terms of making sure that our animals don't present any form of danger or risk to the population of whatever it might be in Australia. So as much as I agree with you, and I would love to do that, honestly, I'd like to have a flight coming in every week with these kind of numbers, but it's just really not economically possible at this stage of the game.
And I understand why. The cup half full in your answer, though, I can hear, Ray, is that, let's say, Howard Buffett's father, let's say Pierre Omidyar, who is a billionaire who lives in the state of Hawaii, let's say Michael Bloomberg. I mean, there are a lot of people out there. Let's say several people became aware of what's going on and started pouring funds into the effort. I mean, I've heard you say it's $75,000 to move a rhino. If enormous amounts of funds were brought forward, and understanding the sensitivity of the South African government, I get it that they're sensitive about it, but I guess they also must realize what's going on. So if the money was there, could you do more?
Unquestionably. Unquestionably. You know, Dave, I really appreciate all this research you've done here. It makes a massive difference. But I was asked some time ago in an interview, a question which I hadn't been asked before, and he said, "So Ray, why are you doing this?" And it wasn't something that I consciously thought about at all. I'm not a hero, Dave. Trust me. I'm just an ordinary guy who's got bad knees from rugby. And I said to him, well, his name's Ben. And I said, Ben, if you or Dave Lawrence or I don't do something about it, who is going to do something about it? I think a lot of people care, Dave. They do care. But then they move on to the next thing in their lives, as you know, they've read an article. It's very few who actually step up. And Mr. Buffett is clearly one who has said, let's do something about this. And you would hope that $25 million would make a difference. And I'm sure it has in a fashion. But it certainly hasn't brought the numbers down, which at the end of the day, that and the demand issue are the key issues in this thing.
I don't discount that money at all. And I think that is such a huge, generous. I was stunned when I read that last night in the Sydney Morning Herald article when I was studying up for this interview, that guy did that. The silver lining that I see constantly, Ray, is there are people who care. What your point is, I think, really is that it's about harnessing it, making sure there is exposure, finding, linking the people together to create the wall of support. And touching back to your 80, you have made this mention that you want to move 80. Do you have 80 rhinos earmarked? How does your plan move forward next?
The key now is we're in the hands of the Australian government, the biosecurity guys. We think that we've responded and answered pretty much everything that they've asked for. There's some steps obviously before that, but the next major step is for the Australian government to go and inspect the quarantine facilities in South Africa, Dave. And that's good, because you know, if you can make sure there's no issues before they get in the aeroplane, better still. They then come to Australia, by the way, and also go into quarantine for a period, which will probably be 2 to 3 months, which is fine too. But that's basically the next step in terms of where we are in the process. And in terms of identification of 80, no, we don't. But I do think, Dave, just without digressing in some way, this decision by CITES, about the CITES decision, is an important one, because there have been a number of people who have basically accumulated a lot of rhinos and a lot of rhino horn in the hope, or perhaps expectation, that the trade would be legalized and they can cash in on what is a stunningly expensive commodity. And now that that's gone away, and given the fact that there's a lot of personal risk in this as well, Dave. So the guy, you know, Dave Lawrence, he owns his game farm. He likes to go there on weekends just to see the animals and see giraffe and zebra and that kind of thing. All of a sudden, he's at risk, because if he's got rhinos, the people know he's got rhinos. They're going to come after his rhinos. And the risk to the personal security of the people who are trying to defend or protect those animals is growing kind of on an exponential basis as things go along. So I think, and I might be wrong on this, is I think the price of rhinos, which is the important part, because there is a trade in rhinos in South Africa, and that's fine. You know, you've got a game farm, you want to get some rhinos or some elephants, that actually happens. So I think that trade is going to come to a halt, and the prices of rhinos is going to come down dramatically, which might act in our favor, Dave. That's a long explanation to your question, but I think you know where I sit when it comes to the trade debate.
I would never think that it was possible to sell that stuff, because you're just feeding the demand. There's just no...
Yeah, you're so right, Dave, and it's just bloody awful as far as I'm concerned. Anyway.
Good news is, though, it sounds like if you can get more philanthropists behind you, we can ramp up your efforts, it sounds like. Now, where are you on this facility? Is the facility in South Africa, the quarantine, is it built and up and ready for your Australian officials to inspect?
Yes, it is. In fact, I'll be there on Monday. I'm going to South Africa tomorrow, and I'll be there on Monday. And it's a very impressive setup. Dave, in fact, there are a number of rhinos going out of South Africa at any point in time. So I'll be there on Monday. No, they're ready to go. They're waiting for us to get the go-ahead from the government.
Let's suppose that places like Kruger can never be made safe for them in Africa. Because you have said in your proposal that you would eventually like to repatriate, I guess, the rhinos to Africa. But would you, knowing what's going on, what we are talking about, because obviously you do know what's going on, would you just keep the rhinos in Australia where you know they will be safe? It won't be perfect, but at least you know they won't be poached there.
Dave, yes. I mean, we kind of hope and pray that they will sort this out and international crime syndicates will move on to their next target, which I don't hope they'll do all issue because that'll inevitably be elephants and they are being slaughtered, as you well know. We discussed this in our board meetings and is that it'll have to be a meeting of the minds between whoever's going to take the rhinos back and ourselves to make sure that it is safe. And I don't see that in the foreseeable future. I really don't, Dave. I mean, I can't see anything that'll change this except political will. So if the president of South Africa and the president of Mozambique and the president of Vietnam and the president of China, you know, all sit around the table and say, look, we're going to stop this nonsense and mean it, I think it's going to continue.
Next step is you're going to go, you're going to inspect the facility in South Africa, you're going to make sure it's up and ready for their visit, and then how far do you think it's going to be before you get
I don't know, Dave. We're in the hands of the governments, and they do things at their own pace. In this case, they are unbelievably thorough and diligent, and I'm quite fine with that. You know, we'll just do, every time we're asked for something, we'll try and provide it as fast as we can just to accelerate that, to make their lives easier, because making their lives easier is going to make our lives easier, no doubt about that.
How about the South African government? Are they resistant to the plan or are they supportive?
No, they're supportive. Originally, there was a bit of resistance, but there was a bit of a misunderstanding there too, quite frankly, but we sorted that misunderstanding out, and now I think that they'd rather it wouldn't happen, as we all would, but they understand and they're supportive, and it's Dave, I'm talking to you here from Sydney, you're in Hawaii, and it's a global issue, and unless it's addressed globally, it will never resolve, and I'm sure the South African government feels that way too.
When you talk about China and Vietnam, you mentioned them, as governments, do you get a feel for where they are officially on this crisis and how involved they are in trying to stop it?
Oh, Dave, I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, I think that, well, and I know it's illegal because it's illegal worldwide, globally. I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that question. I mean, it's a damn good question, but I'll try and answer it another way. I was in Hong Kong about a year ago, and I was telling a lady who's a local Hong Kong person, very articulate, very smart, very well educated about what we're doing, and she made the analogy of the shark fin soup and so on. And she said, let me show you something. And we went one street back from one of the major streets in Hong Kong, and here were all of these local shops, and they had shark fins hanging from the ceiling. It was just mind-blowing, Dave. So, you know, I don't know. China's a hell of a big country, and look, and these traditions go deep, so I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's why this is such an existential crisis, because you got the most populous country in the world consuming this stuff. I don't know another way to do it other than to literally evacuate these rhinoceros to fortified positions where they have armed guards, it seems like. I don't know that they could be, I mean, in Kruger, are there fences?
No, there's no fences, but with Mr. Buffett's money, I know that they're trying to create an area within Kruger which will be like a Fort Knox, but there's no fences, and hence the poachers come. I mean, it's a full moon tonight. The poachers come across the border tonight, and there's no fence, and they risk their lives with lions, leopards, elephants, snakes, rangers, and risk their lives because the returns are so great.
The orphaned rhino, Ray, is that also part of the new phenomenon? I saw the organization Care for Wild Africa, I've sort of been paying attention to, Petronel.
Yes, she's a wonderful lady, though.
Is that something that's emerged as a sort of necessity to look after the babies?
100%. 100%. And on Monday, I'm actually going to one, and I'm seeing Petronel the following week. So exactly right. Now, if anything was going to touch your heart, Dave, and you sound like a passionate person, is that when you hear a little baby cry, a little baby rhino cry, it's just like hearing a child cry. Well, the rhinos get airlifted because the little orphans, and I'll send you a video which will break your heart, of this little orphan, and the rangers may just sedate it, and they put it in a helicopter, and they take it to Petronel's place. And she's a tiny slip of a woman, and she has a lot of volunteers working with her. Interestingly, the volunteers pay her to do the job, which I think is a really creative way of paying for what she does. And these girls, generally girls, will sleep that night and the following night with this little orphan to give it a feeling that it's its mother. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just, you know, what, as you said, has the world come to this, you know, this kind of stuff is required. I mean, it's wonderful. It's wonderful, but Jesus, is there a necessity for it, or why is it necessary?
When I see it, the same thing. I mean, I'm considering actually doing that and going and volunteering there and giving them a couple grand to spend a couple weeks. It's like literally you're paying to then look after an animal whose mom was executed.
Yeah. If you want to do that, keep in touch, and I'll put you in touch with her. She's a wonderful, wonderful woman. Wonderful woman.
I would like to try to put some of the other voices who you think are critical to telling the story of what's happening. So that could be
terrific.
People who are on the ground in South Africa who are doing it, other people who are running these shelters for the animals, whoever it is. I really like to talk to them and try to get their part of the story.
I'll happily do that. I'll talk to them while I'm there because I'm seeing a lot of people in the next couple of weeks.
Excellent. Do you see any influence of the princes? It seems to gain some publicity having them on board. Do you see things like that as a critical part of the story, gaining people like that, and has his role in keeping his mother's interest in these animals alive? Do you see that as an important part of helping the rhinos?
I do, Dave. I believe that absolutely passionately. I think that it helps in the West. I don't know that the guys who are the poachers or the consumer of this stuff actually understand who they are, what they are, what they're trying to do, but I absolutely do. I'll tell you, a couple of years ago when I started this thing and I thought I would try and get the attention of as many people as I possibly could, I wrote to a lot of people. I wrote personal letters to Prince William, Prince Harry, Prince Charles. I wrote it to President Obama. I wrote it to Secretary Clinton. I wrote to David Attenborough. I wrote to, I can just keep on naming them. And some of them came back were very positive and said, well done what you're doing and congratulations. I didn't get one back from the President Obama. I'm quite upset about that. Have you got an influence there, Dave?
I would really like to. You know, a guy like the president could make so much happen. He has so much pull. I'm going to do everything I can to try to get the word out there for you, Ray. Believe me. I mean,
I'll tell you what. I'll drop you an email and I'll attach the letter I wrote to him.
I would,
for the hell of it.
Anything I can do to try to spread the word. If people want to support you, they can go to the Australian Rhino Project website and make a contribution there. Is there any other particular word that you want to put out there into people's ears for things that a call to action from our listeners?
Oh, look, fundraising is critical. And we do, by the way, have an arrangement with an organization in the U.S. where your donors will get a tax deductibility. So that should make a huge difference.
So it's tax deductible and you're donating to essentially, because you guys have nonprofit status in Australia officially, right?
That's right. And we've got that in the U.S. as well. So that's a benefit to your listeners. The funding for our project comes from fundraising, literally, and running events.
Okay.
I do this full time because I want to do it and I believe in it. I don't get paid for it.
That's fantastic. I really appreciate it. It's the founder of the Australian Rhino Project, and my boss sent him a couple of articles about you, my general manager. He's from England, believe it or not. Michael Titterton is his name. He was very impressed with you, and really was impressed with you. You're doing God's work. It's really incredible. If you ever find that you need more people on your team, I hope that you think of me, man, because I would come there in a heartbeat to help you. I'm really...
You'd be very, very welcome. And if I can facilitate that, you're spending a couple of days with Petronel, it'll open your eyes and it'll make your heart feel a lot better than it does when we're talking about this thing.
I really appreciate your time, Ray. I hope this was okay for you, brother.
Oh, look, I really enjoyed speaking to you, Dave. I appreciate your interest and your passion. And it's people like you who can make this thing, you know, turn a dream into reality.
It hits home. And we'll try to keep as much attention on it as we possibly can, Ray. I'm so touched by their plight, and they look so desperate. And just to do something to help them, reach out, and we will stay in touch and have a very safe trip when you're over there. I mean, Hawaii is a beautiful place, too.
I know it's a beautiful place. I love it.
I mean, maybe we could, you know, Big Island is a big island. There's a lot of room, you know.
Well, I'm sure they roamed there in days gone by, so let's bring some out there, Dave.
You know what I mean? There's got to be a room for some rhinos there. I'm giving you a big hug, Ray. And
thanks so much, Dave. Thank you for support. You sound like a wonderful man.
You're a hero, dude. We'll talk again soon, I hope.
I will do. Look after yourself.
You too. God bless.
Cheers, Dave. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.